You are listening to the Cycling Podcast at the 2018 Tour de France in association with Rafa. From grand tours to group rides, the Champs-Élysées to coffee shops, Rafa exists to celebrate the world's most beautiful sport. Today we're in Pau.
Where are we, François?
Well, we're at Le Viscos, one of the famous, it's become a milestone of my Tour de France since 2000. We're in, 2018, so it's been 18 years I've been coming to Le Viscos. It's a hotel and a restaurant in Saint-Savin, and it's at the bottom of the Tourmalet, not far from Cotteret, from the town square, the village square here. You can see Hautacam, where so many, Tour de France stages took place as well. So we're in the deep in the heart of the Pyrenees,
I mean, you were greeted like the prodigal son. I haven't seen such a warm welcome since Arnaud Démare appeared back at the FDJ bus today after the stage.
Yeah, that's a bit like it. I feel like at home, and it's like family to me, the people here. So a great place to be.
A little podcasting drink has been delivered.
Well, it looks good so far, doesn't it? It's a beautiful setting. And the restaurant is open for business.
François has just been presented with a Marseille shirt from about 1992 with number 2 on the back.
Yep, absolutely.
What's this?
Well, there's a friend of mine come in here very often, but he's a cycling fan as well, and he's from Marseille like me, and we share a passion for Olympique Marseille, of course, and we exchange trophies from time to time. So he's staying here with his family at the moment, riding his bike, and he brought a Marseille jersey, as a gift to me. I didn't know he would be here, and I didn't know he had a gift for me, so it's a very pleasant surprise.
Very nice.
Before we get too relaxed here, we should actually talk about this. I should say as well, coming up in tonight's episode, something a little bit different. One of the segments will be, we'll hear from various people who've known Geraint Thomas over the years. And we struck us this morning that we hadn't spoken a lot about Geraint Thomas because we have, I suppose, followed his career for so long. He's so familiar that we haven't gone back and revisited Geraint Thomas. Who is Geraint Thomas? So we spoke to a few people who've known him for a long time, and we'll hear that little package later on. But we've got a stage to talk about first. We should have opened tonight's episode with a bit of an apology to Arnaud Démare.
Well, we'll come to that.
Give us a tale of the attack.
Well, very straightforward today. Stage 18 to Pau, 171 kilometres of mostly flat road, and there was a 5-man breakaway. The first hour was extremely quick racing, 48.8 kilometres an hour, possibly a tailwind, but certainly a very quick start to the stage.
Or an ass wind, as Francois called it.
A tailwind is an ass wind, yeah. Oh, and we've got local beer here. Is that right? La Bigorre? Yes, that must be. Anyway, 5 riders were in the break. Luke Durbridge and Matt Heyman of Mitchelton Scott, Nicky Terpstra of Quickstep, Thomas Boudat of Direct Energy, and Guillaume Van Kuusbroek of Wanty Group Gobert. They were never really allowed any real headway. With 20 kilometres to go, the gap was back down to 25 seconds, and it was game over 3 kilometres later, and that set up the sprint finish. And Arnaud Démare of Groupama FDJ won ahead of another Frenchman, Christophe Laporte of Cofidis. Now, Cofidis weren't terribly happy about the finish. They thought Démare moved a bit too much from one side of the road to the other. To me, anyway, it looked like Démare, while he did move across the road, he was going in a straight line. If that doesn't sound too much like a contradiction, it wasn't like he shut the door on Laporte.
It wasn't like he held onto a car.
It wasn't like he held onto a car. I mean, you missed my pun. The centrepiece of the tale of the attack.
Oh, sorry.
Just by talking over it.
Yeah, do it again. He closed the door on Laporte.
You were taking longer to get there than Alexander Christophe.
Well, Alexander Kristoff was third, and Edvald Bosenhagen of his Norwegian compatriot was fourth. Well, not many sprinters really left in the Tour. Peter Sagan, who was really bashed up after his crash yesterday, a creditable eighth, really. I mean, amazing that he even contested that sprint. No changes overall, and the jerseys all remain on the same sets of shoulders. Geraint Thomas, of course, still in yellow, 1 minute 59 ahead of Tom Dumoulin. And tomorrow's mountain stage, the very famous climbs, the Tourmalet, the Aubisque, that's going to tell us, probably tomorrow night we'll be able to say whether or not Geraint Thomas is going to win the Tour. Following the success of our grand tour of parts of Britain in the spring, we're going back on the road in the autumn. And the first date that we can announce is in Cardiff at St David's Hall on Tuesday the 27th of November, kicking off or rolling out at 7:30 p.m. If you'd like to buy tickets for the event, go to stdavidshallcardiff.co.uk. That's stdavidshallcardiff.co.uk. And our cast will be unveiled nearer the time. It could be any of us. We're hoping to announce further dates for the autumn shortly.
A community around the world, stories and films with the most compelling characters, the world's finest apparel, explore the world of cycling with Rafa.
Hi, it's Fleck from Rafa. At Rafa, we believe that cycling transforms lives and that cycling is the answer to many of our daily problems and challenges. For me, it gives me the headspace to think about the people dearest to me and focus on the most important things in life. It's amazing where your mind goes when you give it time to wonder. We have 23 Rafa clubhouses around the world with 300 rides a week with thousands of people. So wherever you are, we invite you to ride with us. Head to rafa.cc to find a ride near you.
Thank you very much to Rafa. And as you heard there, you can join Rafa to watch the closing days of the Tour de France or go for a ride with Rafa. Something happening, exciting happening in the Rafa Berlin clubhouse this Friday evening. They're celebrating the end of the tour with a bit of a party night with French artist Cleo. Do you know her? Francois?
What's her name?
Cleo. Cleo.
No.
I look, she's a singer, and I actually listened to some of her stuff, and it's pretty nice. So that's happening at the Rafa Berlin Clubhouse on Friday evening.
Is she a wailing vocalist?
she has a little bit a little bit of that.
What a surprise.
Rafa.cc/Berlin. Yeah, it's definitely my
Maybe appeals to your ears.
On the stereo tomorrow. Arnaud Démare then, the man of the day. And I don't think we were explicit last night, but we reported a tweet from Andrew Greipel, who on studying Démare's apparent times on the final climb in particular yesterday, sort of cried foul. He suspected foul play. Now, Démare was quite hurt by that and tweeted back, and then Greipel apologised. There was a mistake with some of the data, and we saw pictures of Démare, you know, coming up the final climb. He was surrounded by people all the time. I don't see how he could have got away with holding onto a car, as was insinuated. So a bit of an apology there to Arnaud Démare. But you spoke to him this morning, Francois.
Yeah, and he was, well, as he was in his tweet this morning, he was incensed by the Greipel's tweet. He accepted the apology, but said, you know, it was not enough, because he said, you know, his honor, his family, sponsors, his jersey, everything had been, you know, kind of tarnished by the comments made by Greipel and by the ignorance of the real the real data. He apparently sent Greipel his data by email to and it was the reason why Greipel replied and apologized, because he didn't have the right data. As you know, these days it's very easy to go to some of the sites like Strava or others and have have the impression that you have the right data and the right figures, when actually sometimes it's right, sometimes it's not. And in this case, I mean, everybody at the end of the stage today at the FDJ bus, there was no it was definitely, all of them said it had been the major motivation, the little spur Arnaud Démare needed to go a little step forward and win a stage at last. It really spurred him into reaction, and they all of them, I talked to Garnieri, I talked to, all the team directors and Fred Grubb that we might hear a little bit later, all of them said, this victory is really a revenge from the comments and the doubts made. All of them pointed out that, there was always a commissaire next to Démare on the climb, and there was also Yvon Madieu even told me that there was a Bora Ansgrohe car, staying with Démare in the last climb all the way up. Was it to kind of check whether he was doing things regularly or for any other reasons unknown to me? But so obviously, you know, in this, I'm not saying that in the past some sprinters, including Demar, have not had, you know, a history of towing and drafting. But in this case, apparently, all the, you know, all the regulations were respected. So apologies if last night we sounded a little bit
skeptical. Well, the skepticism probably arose not just because of Andre Greipel's tweet, and I think this is a lesson to all of us, and particularly us after, or me after the press conference episode on the rest day, where I was talking about the use of data and this kind of reliance on it, and the fact that at the moment the technology is not quite there. There are gaps in the data, it's unreliable. It's a bit like when your mobile phone signals, you know, trying to pick you up as your blue dot when you're using it as a GPS. You know, sometimes it's lagging behind. You know, Strava sometimes can drop out, and or the GPS unit doesn't transmit data. So it is a bit dangerous to kind of impugn somebody's reputation on the basis of that. And we were guilty, I guess, of going with Andre Greipel, you know, a very experienced professional. You know, if he calls foul on it, then, you know, that has a certain weight to it. But of course, this all stems back a couple of years to Milan-San Remo, which Arnaud Demar won. And there was eyewitness testimony from Matteo Tosato and Eros Capecchi, two riders who alleged that Demar, having lost contact after a crash, came past them on the Cipressa at, well, they said double the speed. And the inference, the allegation, which they didn't back down from, mm-hmm. was that Demar had come past taking a tow, either from a sticky bottle or holding onto the car window. Now, obviously, Demar denied that at the time. So that's kind of where all of these things kind of came from. But
it's interesting. I mean, Greipel said, lesson learned, don't comment when you don't have the full facts. The problem is that as soon as something is made public, not everybody sees the retraction or the apology. And I see even tonight people still, you know, talking or asking us about Demar apparently cheating. They haven't caught up with the subsequent retraction. That's the problem. That's the world we live in. And you know, if something's fake news, it doesn't necessarily get corrected.
Well, which is why it's so important.
And it still survives on the internet.
Which is why it's so important that, you know, we were just reporting what Greipel said yesterday, but it's important that we're kind of upfront about it today and just clear all that up.
Yeah, we've seen recently Photoshop, you know, fixings of pictures, you know, being all over the internet, and the immediate reactions from the fans and sometimes from our colleagues, but well, hopefully not too often, are, you know, immediate, and when you find that, you know, it was a montage and not a real picture. I mean, it's we must, you know, exert extreme caution these days. You know, let's wait a bit and you know, have everything confirmed, like in the old days, in a way. You know, let's double check every time we can. I guess last night we were reporting Greipel's tweet, so in a way, you know, we were not exactly going with it. But yeah, by the simple fact that we just, you know.
Yeah, we reported the tweet. But you know, yes, as Lionel explained. Did you spoke to people from the Arnaud Demar, Francis Dujeux camp. Shall we hear from some of them now?
Absolutely. So I talked to his lead out man, Jacopo Garnieri, was very, very you know, angry at Greipel. I also spoke to Fred Grapp, who is the FDJ team coach and, you know, in sports director. And, well, this is what they had to say.
Actually, he was not the only one. As Arnaud said on Twitter, we always had the jury with us when we are dropped. And as for me, I think it's purely useless to complain on Twitter or with the media or whatever, because there is the jury. If you have a doubt on somebody, you can go to the jury and say your point of view, and then they can take a decision. So if you really have you are so sure about somebody hanging on a car, just go to the jury. So for sure that gave us an extra boost, so I could say thanks, Andre. I'm not dwelling confidence with the guys who are here. I know Andre pretty well. I always loved him. So I like it. He apologized, but anyway, it was a really bad tweet he did about it yesterday. So for sure, first time I will meet him, there will be time to clarify.
Victory at last for Arnaud, that's really great.
Yes, it's a great victory for us, for the team today. It was a long time during the start of the start of the Tour de France, and always fighting for all the riders. It was very difficult for Arnaud the two last days with alone fight on him during all the stage. And today with all the teammates, it's a great victory for Groupama FDJ. Yes.
Greipel's tweet yesterday, I suppose, helped a little bit. It was an extra motivation for Arnaud.
We don't understand the tweet of Greipel because this tweet is wrong. Arnaud was always in front of him. Yes, always alone in the effort, but sure, it was very difficult for him, and was no alone, always alone, but no problem with that. Yeah.
The cycling podcast is supported by Science in Sport.
Whether you're grinding up the French Alps or just taking your mates on a local loop, Science in Sport Rego Rapid Recovery Plus will help you recover faster after your ride, so you're ready to go again the next day.
Science in Sport, fueled by science.
Thank you to Science and Sport for sponsoring the cycling podcast and allowing us or helping us to be here covering the Tour de France. You can get 25% off all your Science and Sport products at scienceandsport.com with the code SISCP25. So we heard there before the info from Guarnieri and Fred Grapp from Francis Dejeux. Lionel?
Well, I was just going to say, you know, Demar last year, he won a stage in Vittel, didn't he, on the day that Sagan and Cavendish collided, and that his victory was really totally overshadowed in the sort of news agenda. And then, of course, he was ill in the mountains and took half of his team out of the race because they all waited for him, thinking that maybe they could keep him in the race and he'd recover from the illness and perhaps contest the sprint stages afterwards. A pretty disastrous set of decision-making on that particular day. And in this tour, he's been there or there about, but he's certainly not been on the level of Gaviria when he was here, and not on the level of Sagan.
Groenewegen.
Or Groenewegen, of course, won two stages before. But they all, you know, they failed to make it through. Gaviria and Groenewegen failed to make it through the mountains. For Groupama FDJ, an important victory because obviously they're here without Thibaut Pinot. David Gaudu has, well, we're waiting for him to really do something in the mountains, aren't we?
No, I mean, this is pretty good. I know that was just a joke. I mean, he's been riding pretty well.
He has been pretty good, and he's got up the road quite a few times. I thought he would be pushing for the white jersey a lot more than he has been.
Well, we discussed that with Pernal and other guys before. Really, the instructions for Gaudu this time is to learn, take his time, get accustomed to the old Tour de France circus, and go for it when he felt he had the legs. I think he was 13th in the short stage yesterday. So he's here, and we know that the talent he has. My impression is was he was told to really take it easy on this tour.
We'll just have to be patient, won't we, Francois?
Yeah, we have to wait for Gaudu. Of course. Oh, of course.
Well, the other today was, as you said, Lionel, a very fat. It wasn't a stage that we were all that excited about, but it was very, very fast, and a very, very strong break went clear. It could have been E3 or something. It was a break of super strong ruler types. Nicky Terpstra was there, Matt Hayman, Luke Durbridge, and at the finish I spoke to Matt Hayman. They never had very much of a lead, and something that Matt said at the finish was, I thought, was quite interesting.
A tough day out there.
Yeah, it was.
Is that an understatement?
You have to try hoping for a bigger group originally, and then maybe even hoping for a bit more selective race at the end, that maybe we could, you know, even though we had two in the break, that maybe somebody like Daryl Impey could jump across or something. Yeah, we're running out of chances and wouldn't normally be a stage for us, but yeah, we had a go and they just didn't give us much time. And that's the new cycling in the old days.
That's a trend though, isn't it?
I mean, yeah, good tactic, I guess, but in the old days. Talk about the old days.
It could have been a Belgian classic there with the makeup of that group.
We had enough horsepower, but and actually after there was a bit of a skirmish by the intermediate sprint where two guys tried to make bridge across, which I thought might actually give them a wake-up call that they were keeping us on too tight a leash, and we might be able to get an extra 30 seconds, and that's probably all we needed. Top of that last climb is quite a fast downhill, and obviously they know from Bodnar last year he came very, very close, so yeah, they were never going to give us much.
It was Matt Hayman there mentioning that they were never given very much of an advantage at all. And he said, you know, they didn't need an awful lot because they were very strong riders there. But he made this comment about being the new cycling, you know, and it does seem to be a deliberate strategy by the sprinters teams to not let breaks go out, have the sort of leads they used to have, and then I guess they're managing their efforts just more consistently over the day. As he said, it was a sensible strategy.
Yeah, they don't want to put themselves in a position that they might not be able to get out of. And when you think of the factors, the very fast start, the identity of the riders in that break, I mean, who's going to let Durbridge, Heyman, Terpstra, Van Kiersbroek, not to say anything of Boudin, who I'm sure is strong, but those other four are, you know, super strong riders. Who's going to let them get 5, 6, 7 minutes up the road on a 171-kilometre stage? You'd be asking for trouble. So you end up with this kind of...
And Van Kiersbroek was in the earlier move that almost, you know, that threatened to stay clear because it was, again, a very strong group.
Yeah, it was interesting because it was clearly one of those days where they needed the break to go. And in the end, I think the peloton possibly, you know, may not have been happy with the composition of the break, but let it go and kept it on a very tight leash. And, you know, that's how it turns out sometimes.
But maybe the eight-man teams also, you know, change the tactics a little bit. You have one guy less, you know, to chase behind the SKP. So maybe the idea is to chase down a little bit earlier or not let the gap go that far, because otherwise you might be in trouble maybe.
But when we got to the finish, it was a pretty clean sprint, but I could see why Cofidis would chance their arm, and we gather that Cedric Vasseur went to have a word with the jury.
That's
and
right.
Have a look at the video. Francois, you spoke to the Cofidis camp.
Yeah, I talked to Christian Guiberteau, who is one of the team directors. He used to be with Team Sunweb in the past, and now he's with Cofidis. And yeah, they were a little bit angry and disappointed because, I mean, it's Christophe Laporte's best result on the tour ever. He's second, he's a couple of top five finishes. I mean, one of the up-and-coming sprinters in the team. He actually replaced, I mean, Cedric Vasseur put his trust in him instead of Nasser Bouhanni. So there was lots of pressure on his shoulders. And, you know, by very little, I mean, had the sprint been irregular, there might have been a chance, but they so as you said, you know, there was obviously Demar changes his line in the sprint, but he does it in a kind of straight way. I mean, you see what I mean? It's not a sudden shoving movement to the right or to the left. It just, you know, he often does this actually. Demar,
he did it last year in Vittel,
yeah.
In fact,
yeah.
And you know, if you're in the front, you can choose your line.
Absolutely.
As long as you don't make it dangerous. You can make it further for the guy behind you to come
absolutely,
around.
Yeah.
That's a legitimate tactic.
And so the Cofidis were, you know, protested officially to the race jury. Cedric Vasseur went in video bus to watch the tapes with the commissaires, and I mean, and the decision was pretty unanimous that there was no problem with that. And even Guiberteau, you know, in the end, despite the disappointment, told me even if the sprint had been 100% clean, that's very, very great serious doubts that Christophe Laporte could have overtaken Demar, who was strongest today.
It was a protest of a team that hasn't won a stage at the Tour de France for 10 years.
Yeah, that's but right. What a way. If they had got the result had gone their way, woo! World's smallest party popper to celebrate that victory. And from our, you know, I don't think Cedric Vasseur could have opened the champagne with a straight face, surely.
Hey, don't forget! You can listen to Kilometre Zero, our morning show, every weekday during the 2018 Tour de France. Kilometre Zero is supported by Hansgrohe.
Little reminder there to listen to Kilometre Zero. I'm not sure that's the pronunciation of Hansgrohe that Hansgrohe asked us to do, but that's our French podcasting voiceover lady. You know, can't get the staff, can we? Anyway, a reminder to listen to Kilometre Zero, which is released Monday to Friday. Today was, the day that Lionel and I spent up the Col de Porte yesterday, waiting for the finish, watching the whole stage and waiting for the finish of the short 65-kilometre stage. 2 days ago, it was a day with Cofidis, with Cedric Vasseur, and that's where we learned about the champagne.
Yeah, let's not spoil it. Yeah, the champagne's in the fridge for a purpose.
Go back to that. Orla spent the day with Cedric Vasseur, who's changing things at Cofidis. And, you know, they've done okay. I mean, I think they've been pretty visible, and they've featured a lot of breaks, and they're knocking on the door.
Well, when you look at the number of teams winning stages on this Tour de France, quite diverse and varied, and hopefully for Cofidis they can open the battle on the Champs-Élysées. There's one sprint yet to come. It'll be an open, very open one. I mean, Christophe, you know, will obviously want to win it. Arnaud Demar Well, will he survive the last mountain stage tomorrow? That's another question mark. Mm. Christophe Laporte is pretty good at actually going through the mountains. And if nobody, no other sprinter is left in the race, maybe because Peter Sagan is also, you know, struggling a little bit with his, after his crash. So maybe it, you know, finally Cofidis might, you know, manage to win the stage and end the stage on the Champs-Élysées, which would be obviously a great place to open a bottle of champagne.
Tomorrow's final Kilometre Zero is a look at the career of Sylvain Chavanel, who is on course to finish his 18th Tour de France, which is a record. Today he was presented with a cake to celebrate 365 days on the tour.
Just a correction, he had two of those races he didn't finish.
Yeah, that's right.
It's a record number of participation.
Pardon.
2007 he pulled out because the Cofidis team withdrew after the whole shenanigans with the Italian rider. Christian Moreni, that's right, who tested positive and they all pulled out in the Pyrenees. And 2012, I think it was, he was injured or ill, one or the other. Didn't get through the mountains.
Still, remarkable record, 365 days on the tour as of today. And we spoke to quite a lot of people who have known Sylvain Chavanel over his career, and that's coming out tomorrow, so listen out for that. Geraint Thomas, we were going to talk about. Before we do, let's just have a quick look ahead to tomorrow and the final day in the Pyrenees. And we were talking about this in the car on the way here. It's really a case of who's happy with where they are at the moment. Geraint Thomas obviously is. Tom Dumoulin may be disinclined to risk second place in the pursuit of the win. And so his tactics may be on the conservative side. The guy who's got everything to gain tomorrow is Primoz Roglic, who's fourth. There's a chance of a podium for him. Fourth would be a fantastic result for him, but when you're so close to the podium and when your rival for the podium has cracked on the last mountain stage, Chris Froome, there's everything for him to go for. And that team has Stephen Kruijswijk up there as well. You know, they've got quite interesting cards to play tomorrow, and I expect them to be the ones to try something.
You know, maybe I'm blinded by my admiration for Tom Dumoulin and his panache, you know, but I keep hoping he'll try something tomorrow, you know, because he's apart from Geraint Thomas, is the and the penalty, you know, the time penalty he suffered, and we talked about it in the last podcast. He's been impeccable throughout, and he tried, you know, he tried things. I'm not saying that he's going to take lots of time off, Geraint Thomas, tomorrow. We hope everything goes smoothly for Geraint. No problem, no crashes, no incident. I mean, we want, you know, of course, the cleanest race possible. But I really think at the back of his mind, Tom Dumoulin, the way he rode in the past, maybe not in the Giro, but in the Vueltas, when he started to make an impression, he has to try something, if only for the sake of sports. So I hope we'll see something from Tom Dumoulin as well. And why not? You know, it could be a Dutch coalition. I know Roglic is Slovenian, but we're running for a Dutch team. Could we see, you know, a Dutch trio with Steven Kruijswijk maybe starting from afar, you know, trying to... I don't believe at all Movistar will attempt anything. They have had a stage win with Nairo Quintana.
Well, Mika Landa tonight has said that they will be riding to defend the team's classification and the fact that they've
absolute
got two riders
nonsense.
In the top 10.
This is nonsense.
It's
really
pathetic, isn't it?
I mean, they're one of the biggest teams
maybe
in the world.
Maybe it's a bluff.
But
he's come out with these comments very, very disappointing.
Yeah, we probably can rely, and I'm sure Lionel will agree with that, but Don Martin to do something as well. He has nothing to lose.
He posted a wonderful picture on Twitter tonight. He's saying that if Geraint Thomas wins the Tour de France, he at least can look back on having beaten him in his home tour. He won the Junior Tour of Wales, and he's posted a picture of the pair of them riding side by side up a climb when they were juniors. As I said earlier, we're looking at Geraint Thomas in the yellow jersey, and we're so familiar with Geraint Thomas, so familiar with the Geraint Thomas story in a way. I remember 2007, his first tour, he was 21.
Well, yeah, I was going to suggest doing a sort of small potted biog of Geraint Thomas because, he won Junior Paris-Roubaix in 2004. He was ahead of Ian Stannard. Junior Paris-Roubaix at the time was a new thing. I think it was only the second edition of Junior Paris-Roubaix, and a lot of very good British riders particularly have won that since. And then he was a track rider, part of the Great Britain Academy, set up and run by Rod Ellingworth. In 2005, he was training in Australia for World Cup track events when basically they were out training, crashed, piece of metal flicked up and hit him, and he basically ruptured his spleen, which had to be removed. But everyone always talked about what a fantastic kind of endurance engine he had, but also the top end speed, kind of almost a perfect team pursuit rider. Even as a teenager, he had a very brief and not particularly enjoyable spell as a stagiaire with the Saunier Duval team at the end of 2006. I think he did one race for them and was off the back very early and didn't finish. And then, yeah, like you say, Rich, 2007 he was riding for Barlow World, and really Barlow World got into that tour as a wild card because they were British registered and the tour was starting in London, and Barlow World picked Geraint Thomas because he was a British rider. I mean, it was a real convergence of circumstances that gave Geraint Thomas that first start in the Tour, and he finished second last. Wim van Sevenant was behind him, who I think was a Lanterne Rouge in the Tour at least twice.
Yeah,
maybe
he was
three
at least
times.
Twice, yes, absolutely.
But I remember just something that stands out, you know, seeing him in the village one morning, maybe 8 or 10 days in, and just asking him how it was going, and it's just, yeah, it's pretty hard, isn't it? You know, it was just so understated, and he's still like that now. You know, he didn't sort of overblow things. Then, of course, 2008, it was all about the Olympics, and he was in that, you know, Olympic Games winning team pursuit squad, world record times. 2010, joined Team Sky, of course. That was the point where, well, he was in the white jersey, I think, wasn't he? And he was
second on the cobbled stage that year behind Tor Hushov.
That's right, and was in a great position to perhaps even take the yellow jersey on the first mountain stage. That didn't quite work out.
No, Chavanel took the stage and the yellow jersey, denied
right.
Geraint Thomas.
That's right, exactly. Yeah. And then, you know, there's, some of the it's become a cliche how many times he's crashed, but I mean we were talking about this before, you know, he's crashed in Paris-Roubaix, crashed in winning great positions, crashed in Tour of Flanders at least a couple of times, lost to Paris-Nice because of a crash one year, fractured his pelvis in the 2013 Tour de France, and then rode all the way through. And
stage one, he fractured his pelvis
and got all the way through the whole race. I mean, extraordinary kind of courage and endurance and almost foolhardiness, really, because I guess, you know, the risk of what potential damage he could be doing for the future. And it's always been this question, hasn't it? Has he got what it's required?
Crashed at the Rio Olympics. I think he was probably the strongest guy that day as well.
In the road race.
And he has gone from a track rider. He's had a phase as a someone concentrating on the cobbled classics, and around the sort of 2013-14 years, you know, he was getting top tens in Paris-Roubaix, Tour of Flanders. He won E3 as well, didn't he?
Just on that 2011 Tour of Flanders briefly, because I was watching this again today for the Chavanel Kilometer Zero. Chavanel was second in that race, but, you know, when you watch that back, and Geraint Thomas, 2011, he was still quite young at the start of his career with Team Sky. Juan Antonio Fletcher was their leader. And in that finale, it was Geraint Thomas who was on the front of the chasing group, absolutely working, driving very hard, but again, doing it for somebody else, which we've seen also time and time again. We'll hear this in the package that's coming up, that this has been one of his traits. He's been very prepared, perhaps too prepared sometimes, to sacrifice his own chances for somebody else.
Yeah, I remember talking. I've always been a fan of Geraint Thomas, to be honest, and I think almost every year on the tour since probably 2010, I kept asking Dave Brailsford, so what about Geraint? You know, is he a classics rider? Is he, a one-week stage rider? Or could it be a Grand Tour? And my impression was every time I was getting a different answer because maybe even Dave Brailsford, who's been following him for a long time now, that, you know, was not entirely certain about the potential of Geraint Thomas and what kind of rider he should become. So there we are.
To slot back into that Team Pursuit squad for 2012 as well, when, you know, the times were getting quicker and quicker and the demands of the event, to use their phrase, had changed. I mean, it's quite significant that he's been able to do that, to go from, you know, the ultra endurance of Grand Tours, because, you know, even, well, in recent years, when he's finished 15th a couple of times, well, he's very close to top five, wasn't he, in 2015, collapsed spectacularly on the final Friday. Don't for Geraint Thomas fans out there, you know, don't sort of blame me if that's what happens tomorrow, because I'll have very little bearing on it, really. But it's, I suppose we've been kind of slightly taken him for granted because he's been so adaptable throughout his whole career. And that comment from the Start Village in 2007 has just always kind of stuck with me. It really came back to me when I've been thinking about how well he's ridden during this tour.
I remember David Miller christened him the penguin. He likened him to one of the penguins of Madagascar. He said, you know, kind of cute and cuddly on the outside, but hard as nails on the inside. That dates from 2007. I spoke to Dave Brailsford this morning, actually, about the fact that the stage, that decisive stage to Col de Porte had decided things between Froome and Thomas, and how that had shaken out. And also asked him about his contract situation, because he is out of contract at the end of the year. We don't know whether he's agreed a new contract with Team Sky or not. Here's what Dave Brailsford said this morning.
As you said yesterday, the race sort of dictated things yesterday, and it's very clear order in the team now. But was there anything said last night? Did Chris say anything?
The real key thing, I think, about this whole situation has been maturity of the relationship and the honesty of the relationship between Geraint and Chris. If you have that, there's not a lot of work to do, to be honest, because you've got two guys who are straight up. They both understand the situation that they're in. They both want to win. They both understand how the sport works and the rules of the sport, as well as the rules of respect, really, because I think G totally respects the fact that what Chris has done, and is a big champion, and Chris can respect the fact that G's got good legs and has been going very, very well. And ultimately, it kind of starts to form in a certain situation, but at that moment where it becomes the real pivot point, I think that's where the point of greatest tension is, if you like, is where you're right at the moment where you're going to go one way or another. And the thing I liked about these two is that, guys, look, you're both in a fantastic situation, but what we can't do is be the architects of our own downfall. Either of them wouldn't want that, but it wouldn't be fair on the other team members who've ridden so hard for so long. It wouldn't be fair on all of the staff. It wouldn't be fair on the team. And they've both got enough character and values, if you like, that they were never going
to
do that.
So fair to say, quite a contrast to maybe other similar types of situations you've been in the past.
Well, I think you learn from them, don't you? You know, and myself included, I think when you're first thrown into these situations, you're not sure what's going to happen, and you try and do something with a good intent, and you have unintended consequences you just didn't realise or hadn't thought about. And I think as you get older, you get a bit wiser with these things, but you can't get away from the fact that if you've got two young men who are driven but are fair and honest and straight up with each other, it makes it just looks after itself.
Some people are surprised to see Geraint in the position he's in, but has there been a step up in his commitment this year?
Well, no, I don't think he's always been committed. I think the one thing about Geraint right from the get-go, he's bought into the way his team works. He's just bought in, always bought in, and it's moved him forward over the years. This year was one of the first years where he's really just said, OK, I'm going to focus everything. My whole season is going to be focused on the Tour. So he's raced a little bit less fit than he has done in the past in, you know, some of the earlier races, Paris-Nice and Romandy, and I think that was a bit of a challenge for him at the time, and he had his little setbacks along the way, so I think at times it was a bit frustrating, but he stuck to the process, and he's managed to come here in absolutely top condition, which was the goal. And I think it's probably the first time that he's really arrived at this race in really peak condition.
What is his contract situation? Is he out of contract at the end of this year? Will he be a Team Sky rider next year?
Yeah, he will, yeah.
So that was Dave Brailsford this morning, very confident the team that Geraint Thomas will still be a Team Sky rider next year. Let's finish tonight's episode with our package. We'll hear from various people here who have known Geraint Thomas for a long time, ridden with him, worked with him, and we'll go off and have what I anticipate will be a very nice dinner.
Let's hope so.
Other French flavour tonight before we go, Francois?
Well, you know, I'm kind of overwhelmed by there being at Le Viscos, and you know, I talked about it already. So the only thing that's it's funny. I mean, some of our listeners might be friends of mine on Facebook, and I've been doing a little joke, you know, private joke since the start of the Tour de France, which I call Tour de Flan. I've been trying to eat flan at every stage. Sometimes, well, you kind of witnessed that, and sometimes the flans I was eating were very dodgy. And when I arrived this evening here at Le Viscos, and I was going up to my room, you know, the landlord told me, you know what, Francois, we've prepared the flan for you. So I'm really, really, you know, waiting for that, more than for Godieu.
Nigel Mitchell, head of nutrition at EF Education First, formerly nutritionist at British Cycling and Team Sky. When did you work closest with him?
I think I started working with G when he started on the academy, when he'll have been about, I don't know, 18, 19 years of age. I remember when he'd gone to Australia with Rod and he had that terrible accident and had to have his spleen removed. Yeah, I've known G quite a long time. One of the things I would say about Guy Rant is nobody says a bad word about him. That's one of the things. But he's also one of the toughest characters that I know on the bike. I remember when he'd first turned pro with Barloworld, but he was still based in Carrara in Italy, and he'd often go riding with the academy guys, and he'd had a bad crash. He'd had a crash in a time trial, and he broke his hip or something, he'd done some damage. But one of the things they'd missed were a broken hand. They'd been out riding all day, and he looked really, really uncomfortable on the bike, and stopped for a cup of coffee, and his hand was swollen like twice the size of a normal hand. And I said, does that hurt you? He goes, yeah, it does a bit. Got him re-scanned and found out he got a broken hand. So he'd been riding his bike for hours and hours and hours and hours with a broken hand and not really noticed much about it. I mean, definitely in many ways one of the most professional athletes that I've worked with. And I remember when he was young, just thinking one day when he realises what ability and what talent he's got, and he galvanises everything together, that it'd become an amazing bike rider. And it, you know, obviously the proof is in the pudding, as they say, so now he is.
Brian Holm, sports director at Quickstep Floors.
Can you remember the first time you met Geraint Thomas?
Yes, sir. I think I can. I think it was in London, South Britain, with Kev, Geraint Thomas, Clancy. Three, we had some sponsor stuff with Ulrich, T-Mobile, and I think that he was around also. And then next thing was Rod Ellingwood. The coach of Sky kept telling me about him, kept on saying he was he could win the tour. Actually, I even remember he was with Barloworld, but that was after I met him with T-Mobile. I think then he went to Barloworld, the South African team. And then I also had a good contact with Rod Ellingwood, the coach. And he said he could win the Tour de France one day. And it seems like he was pretty right. And I think with Geraint Thomas, he had that breathing like Brad Wiggins. You notice him. He looked like the lead singer of Arctic Monkeys, doesn't he? You know, like, so he got a twist of that Brit pop we all love.
And what do you think about the way he's ridden this tour?
I just love it. I just love to see him riding his bike. He looks so good on the bicycle. He looked like he'd done it like 10 years before. He looked like Indurain, who got everything under control. Of course, we know his stress inside. He must be boiling, but he looked like he got everything under control. And whatever you say about Sky, they just have a bloody good team.
Ian Boswell, Katusha Alpecin.
Ever train with him?
Yeah, quite a bit. Did a lot of training together. Did some barbecues at the team house in Beausoleil, just outside Monaco. Been to his house for maybe it was his birthday or something. But he's really just an easygoing guy. And I think that's part of the reason why he's I mean, not why he's doing so well here, but he didn't come in here with a lot of pressure like maybe Froome had. You know, anything, if Froome doesn't win, it's kind of a failure. If G every day he has in yellow is like a bonus, you know. So he's riding on kind of this euphoric high of positivity and kind of just rolling with it. And he's a proven talent, you know. He's obviously older to kind of be a first-time Grand Tour contender, but I think everything in his career has kind of led to it. And, you know, he's a well-rounded rider, and I think, as the cycling podcast would say, he, you know, if luck falls on his side, because he tends to have a lot of unfortunate crashes. But he's, yeah, sailed through 18 days now with ease.
How, you know, in your time training with him, racing with him, being a teammate, how good a rider did you think he was?
He's just a natural rider on the bike. You know, he's just comfortable. A lot of the British riders with their track background, they're really smooth on the bike. You look at his development coming from the track, kind of being a classics guy, and then into a GC rider. You know, he has a pretty diverse background of racing and a big skill set. And I think just having that, you know, knowledge from, you know, even something like the team pursuit, you know, he knows how to pace himself, and it was just a matter of, you know, for him, he would probably attest to losing some weight and kind of concentrating on the training it takes for a Grand Tour, which I think has been probably his biggest struggle, but also his biggest attribution to reaching this level, is just his process of learning what it takes and, you know, in training and weight management to ride a Grand Tour.
Stephen de Jong, sports director, Trek Segafredo.
What can you remember and what are your memories of working with Geraint Thomas when you did?
Super good lad, yeah. Really nice working with him always. Not complicated, always good morale. In those days he was still focusing on the classics and, quick learner.
He had a lot of mistakes in races, and this tour, I don't want to jeopardize it, but what do you put those mistakes down to in the past?
Maybe experience, also unlucky. He had some very bad crashes in the past in the tour, and sometimes you have to be lucky also that you just escape some nasty crashes and stay healthy. And I think so far everything goes well, and let's hope for him that it goes well until Paris.
Nigel Mitchell. A lot of people say you need to be ruthless, very selfish to be a Tour de France winner, and that's the thing he's maybe been lacking.
I wouldn't necessarily agree with that. I mean, one of the things that athletes like G's always been able to do is to work to a plan, and timing is everything, and maturing is everything, and it's not just physical maturing, it's also the psychological maturing, that belief that you can do it. For many years, Geraint's job was being the biggest workhorse in the peloton, and that were his job. Every race that he would do, he would be he'd be putting out the highest number of average watts and work, because that's what he'd do, because that's what he was told to do. For me, it's not a huge surprise to see him where he is, and I know on the podcast you've been having big debates about can he do the full 3 weeks and things, and in a way it's a perfect storm for him, because he's got amazing condition, and the other thing that you guys have identified, not having those little mishaps, he's had a perfect Tour de France, and so he's not lost time anywhere at all, he's not shown a chink of weakness anywhere, so for me it'd be fantastic to see him on the top step in Paris. One of the things again that I think Geraint might surprise quite a few people with is we know he's a really good time trialist, but we just might see him even lift it further when he's got the time trial at the on Saturday.
Ian Boswell. Well, he always seemed very straightforward, and not, I don't mean this as criticism at all, but not somebody who would get bogged down in overthinking things. He seems to be easygoing, and is that your impression of him as well?
Exactly. He's super light. I mean, I don't say lighthearted, but he's just an easygoing guy. And, you know, even now in the race, he's come up to me and just chatted with me a couple times, and having the yellow jersey doesn't really change his mood or his, you know, I think he sees everyone the same as he did before, and people see him the same. And he's also a guy that doesn't really speak bad about anyone, you know, and I think he's well respected in the peloton. You know, so, you know, cycling is a sport where there's a lot of talking behind people's backs. He's always a straight guy.
Stephen de Jong.
Was his talent obvious to you when you first started working with him? He'd been a world-class track rider, then a classics rider, now proving it in the Tour de France.
Well, he always had a big engine that you could see, but he was improving over all those years, really progressively on the long climbs, and he did well, but you could see this there was something special with him, yep.
Have you managed to talk to him at all during this tour?
No, not much, no. One time he came past when he won the stage, so I said congrats, but that was it.
But maybe in Paris you'll say congratulations.
I hope so. No, he's a guy who really deserves to win a Grand Tour, and yeah, let's hope everything stays like this for him.
Nigel Mitchell.
When I worked with him in British Cycling and Sky, there were quite a lot of work around weight management. But again, what you tend to find with these athletes is you're really creating an environment that can succeed in. So ensuring that people have got the information and knowledge of what they should and shouldn't be doing with the food, and then the athlete takes the lead with it, really. And the biggest part of that is having that commitment and self-dedication of the athlete to be able to go, yeah, this is how much I know I need to have, and have a plan to work around it. And the way that, you know, the way that they're set up in Sky now with James there, James Morton heading up the nutrition, you know, they've moved things on massively, and so the detail and planning that they go to is fantastic to ensure that they're getting the right nutrients for the recovery, but still to get the weight right down. And again, with somebody like Geraint, because of all the years that he had ridden on the track, it then, and just naturally, you know yourself, Richard, when you ride the track, especially things like Team Pursuit, you naturally bulk up, and people think bulk, what's bulk? And actually, you know, you see these guys gaining quite significant muscle mass. You know, you can see them gaining 2 or 3 kilos of muscle in a track campaign, not fat. So, you know, the track really, the starts, the amount of effort, the forces that they're putting through the body when they're doing the starts is really quite hypertrophic for a lot of these guys. And once you've put muscle on, unless you're really going to starve it off, which can be damaging, you need the body to take time for that to come down. And obviously, G's not ridden the track for quite some time now, so that's given him that opportunity. And also, one of the things that they do in Sky is they spend a lot of time at altitude. Altitude itself, you know, it puts extra stresses on the metabolism, which can help some people from that weight point of view. But the most important thing when you're in the hotel at the top of Teide is you've nothing else to do except ride your bike, have your food and sleep. Up there, the food's good food, but tends to be simple, so you struggle to really overeat there. So it's a really good environment for people to focus on the work they need to do, the training, the recovery, and as I say, it can help with the weight management as well.
You have been listening to the Cycling Podcast at the 2018 Tour de France. Thanks to our sponsors, Rafa and Science in Sport. The music is by Santoré. This episode was produced by John Mooney.